Are you an accredited investor looking for a new opportunity to generate passive income and build the retirement of your dreams? Then elevate your investment game with Viking Capital, where wealth meets wisdom. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting out, Viking Capital can help guide you towards financial freedom through passive real estate investing. With strong and transparent underwriting, Viking identifies low-risk opportunities with the goal of preserving investor capital and maximizing long-term growth potential. And their accessible and responsive investor relations team will help you understand how each investment will impact your unique financial goals. With $800 million in assets acquired, more than $230 million in equity raised, and more than 5,000 units under management, Viking Capital is your path to early retirement. To learn about Viking Capital's latest investment opportunity, which is available for you right now, visit go.vikingcapllc.com/best. That's go.vikingcapllc.com/best to get started today. Did you know that within a decade, women will hold $30 trillion in investable assets? Yet somehow, only 19% of women reported feeling confident in selecting investments that align with their long-term goals. Our friends at InvestHer are out to change that. InvestHerCon is the number one premier conference for women in real estate, and it's happening June 2nd through the 4th in Austin, Texas. InvestHerCon is not just another real estate conference. It's a transformational experience focused on real estate investing, business strategies, and self-care tactics, all designed to help women take control of their financial futures. Gain the knowledge and skills you need to grow your portfolio and build a sustainable business, all while connecting with over 500 women who are playing at the same level. To learn more and to get your tickets, visit InvestHerCon.com today and use the code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. That's InvestHer, HERCon.com, promo code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. Quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
Focus on the cash flow. You can't eat IRR. Don't use projected IRR or projected equity multiple as a tool to make a decision on investing with a sponsor.
Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Hello, Best Ever listeners. Welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm Ash Patel, and I'm with today's guest, Erwin Boris. Erwin is joining us from Ridgewood, New Jersey. He is the Senior Vice President of Investments at Heritage Capital Group. They focus on cash flow investments. Erwin's portfolio consists of 7 million square feet of industrial, small bay flex, 500 units of legacy multifamily. Erwin, thank you for joining us, and how are you today?
Thank you for having me. I'm doing well. And actually, that 500-unit multifamily deal is going into contract to be sold tomorrow. Someone made me an offer I can't refuse, and given what the operating costs are on apartments, I'd rather not wait for insurance prices to come down.
Well, let's start the conversation with that. Is this one property with 500 units?
It's actually 448 units. It's a single property. It's in Virginia Beach. It's right next to Oceana, which is the Top Gun flight school on the East Coast. So you sit at the pool, and the F-18s and the F-35s scream out over the pool, but it's the sound of freedom. And if you're there in the summer times and you're on one of the beachfront hotels, you can be amazed at watching these birds put down on the carrier deck and take off again.
Why are you selling now? This is not a great time to sell.
Well, we've owned it for 6 years. And for us and some of our partners, it was a place to park and exchange when we bought it. We assumed the debt. There's still term on the debt. And the 2x on a multiple. When insurance prices, as everybody know, went crazy, we got kicked out of a multi-asset policy with the management company because the reinsurers dropped out. And then if you were within 10 miles of a coast or you were built pre-2000, they deemed you uninsurable. But it's only a temporary thing. I know that insurance has already come down substantially from where we had to place the insurance a year ago, but it's not what we do. It's not what we focus on anymore. And we'd like to take the money off the table, put it into more industrial logistics, and wait the 18 to 24 months for multifamily market to reprice as all these distressed deals clear the markets. And I call this the great basis reset opportunity. And that's on all asset classes. We know what's going on with office buildings, with people like Brookfield giving them back. And although San Francisco is empty, and even in Manhattan, a lot of them are empty or the rents are coming down. But we like it as an asset class. The family's made its money in that asset class. And we tend to be in asset classes that aren't popular, except now industrial is getting popular. But we have a way of doing what we do to be successful.
Erwin, how many years have you been in this real estate investing game?
Well, I guess if you include my days as an accountant, I was just practicing CPA, I've probably been doing this 30 years. Everything from being the auditor that looked at your books and records to being a lender. I spent 10 years with GMAC Commercial Mortgage, which has now evolved into Bricadia and other lenders, and working for other family real estate platforms. It's been about 30 years. So I've been an owner, an operator, a lender, a broker, an advisor, and I've got to see it from pretty much everybody's point of view.
Have you always done industrial, or was it just a long run of multifamily and now you're pivoting?
No, the principals at Heritage Capital have always done multifamily and industrial with their multifamily. And a few years ago, they sold an asset that the family held for almost 40 years. It was a multi-level industrial building with monstrous mushroom columns. And it's actually the building where they built the engine for the Spirit of St. Louis. Talk about history. There was one portfolio they sold 3 years ago. They held that for 12 years and then redeployed their capital into more industrial. It's a sleepy asset. It's boring. It's so boring, it just pays cash flow. That's why we like it. And we're not buying Amazon or Coca-Cola or Estee Lauder that people want to put on their corporate brochures. We're buying stuff in secondary markets off of main roads where tenants have a need to be there, and the tenants will always be there.
Have you shifted away from multifamily currently? Are you actively looking for multifamily deals?
We are looking, and I've looked at some distressed deals where someone sent me a deal. The sponsor was in distress. Their basis is $180,000 a unit. They're willing to sell it for $110,000 a unit. And my thoughts were they wanted to sell it basically for $1 million over the mortgage just so they don't have a Freddie Mac foreclosure on their record. But I would have to spend $1.5 million to replace the interest rate cap before I brought money in to renovate the rest of the apartments and bring the occupancy up. And it was in the wrong location. It never should have been a deal anybody bought. And we look at a lot of multifamily. And one thing I do is I like to see how many times that they've traded over the last 12 plus years. And sometimes these things trade every 3 or 4 years. And in some of them, I know the assets. I actually am able to find some of the old offering memos from the brokers. And how many times can you tell me the business plan is that you're going to renovate a kitchen and a bathroom and put a new floor in and appliances? Every 4 years, they don't need it. So some of them are laughable. I'd like to buy apartments, yes, because when you think about the day of the internet, you shop online, everything is remote, you get your groceries delivered, but you need a physical place to put your head.
Do you buy retail or office?
We have owned a lot of office over the years. That's how I met the family 20 years ago when I was their banker. And we've cycled out of office with the exception of two really long-term holds. One is in Birmingham, Alabama, and the other one is in Greenville, South Carolina. And those we have very low leverage on, and they're more institutional quality, and nobody's moved out. So I'm not facing any pending vacancies. But office, I think what's going to happen is, although you read about the back-to-work movement, where all the employers want their employees back, they are getting a lot of resistance. So I think a lot of employers, to keep their key staff, are adopting some sort of flexible scheduling. So it may be 3 days or 4 days. And I think what's going to happen is when those leases renew, they're going to scale back slightly. So there's going to be a problem with office. And we're seeing some interesting opportunities on office, but we're not there yet. And again, with the wall of maturities and distress, I think some of the office buildings should be converted to apartments. That's when I worked down on Wall Street, we saw a lot of the C office buildings around us got converted very successfully to apartments. But right now, I'm not ready for office yet. There's no cash flow.
What about retail?
I would buy retail. I'd buy a grocery anchored center where you had the Hallmark store, the dry cleaner, the fast food, the CVS, all that other stuff that was in there. There are some of those that are interesting on a cap rate basis. The question is, what's the longevity? You look at the chain grocery chains like Kroger is merging, Do they downsize some of the stores now? So you have to wait for some of that to shake out. But I think neighborhood retail is always going to be full if it's in the right location, in the right neighborhood, and you got a good traffic pattern. Luxury retail, a lot of the malls, there's always some vacant spaces. Some of the anchors have gone out. And we've tried to buy some of the anchors where they were owned by Lord & Taylor or Kmart. And the municipalities won't let us rezone those. We would have made them either self-storage or industrial.
You guys are all in on industrial with 7 million square feet. Where are those properties located?
We have some great tenants like General Dynamics down in Chesapeake, Virginia, who does a lot of work for the Navy. Also in that same area, I have First Data. You lose your credit card, you call American Express. They call First Data. They get that metal card shipped out overnight to you. They can't move, especially in that location. The building is built around a 20,000 square foot steel vault. But we're in Chesapeake, Virginia, Norfolk, Virginia. We're in Indiana. We're in Ohio, Montana, upstate New York, Pennsylvania. So we look for markets where the tenants have a need to be there. Either you're a special purpose, you need to be there, or you're within a day's drive of either coast. So 65, 75, 85, 95, sort of north to south, 20, 70, 90, 66 go east to west. And again, some of my favorite cities are what we call wheel and spoke. We have a perimeter road that goes around, whether it's Atlanta, whether it's Cincinnati, whether it's Columbus or Indianapolis. Then you have all the highways that bisect it that make it look like a wheel.
Erwin, when you say small bay flex, how small of a property are we talking about?
It's not necessarily a property size. It's your tenant size. So you might have 150,000 square feet, but you might have tenants that are 3,000 square feet. You might have tenants that are 30,000 square feet. And it's flexible, meaning that I could expand or divide the spaces depending on the tenant's need. If I had a 30,000 square foot tenant, 35,000 square foot tenant vacate, I'm slicing it up into three pieces. I got two out of the three pieces leased already. But it's also flexible as far as the tenant's use. You will have delivery doors in the back. And some years that will be 100% office use and finish. And some years it will be 15 or 20% office use and finish. Think of the painter, your electrician, the plumber. They need some office space for their people and they need the place for parts and supplies. The small bay flex, it's also typically, 20 or 24 foot ceiling heights where typical the newer industrial is 32 or 36 or as Amazon builds 90 feet tall buildings now in some municipalities. So it's called flex because it's flexible in use, flexible in size, flexible in finish.
I do want to find out though, what's the smallest property that you'll buy? Is it 50,000, 100,000 square feet?
We bought 130, 145,000 square foot one out in Miamisburg, Ohio a few years back. I'm looking at one now that's 70,000 feet only because I already own a couple miles away. It's sort of an add-on and the seller for some reason just wants out. He's like, make me an offer. I made him a ridiculous offer and he accepted it. I thought he was going to tell me to pound salt, but I'm happy to buy on a 10% return on leverage, fully occupied. So I'm finding in this market, you got to be bold. If you don't ask, you don't get.
Okay. So you're typically around the 100,000 mark or higher.
Yeah, minimum 100 side, but we're also looking at a transaction. We're meeting with a seller next week. It's 850,000 square foot multi-building park. It's the same amount of due diligence and effort to close 100,000 square foot, say a $7 million acquisition as it is to close a $100 million transaction. Same amount of effort, same amount of manpower. So bigger is better. But we sold an industrial portfolio several years back. It was three states, nine cities, and it was all pieced together to get to 2.6 million square feet. So you could also create mass that way if you can connect the dots.
Erwin, in terms of the size of each individual bay, is 10,000 the smallest?
No, typically in small bay, you might have a 5,000 square foot tenant, depending what their need is. The smaller spaces are easier to rent to a point. Bigger spaces tend to be vacant longer. And in the traditional industrial, as people think of distributions, you might have a lot of 50,000 square foot or 80,000 square foot or even larger. We have a property down in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, right outside of Nashville. I have 50,000 square feet. I have Pillsbury. They store all those little blue tubes of popping fresh dough in my building because their factory is down the road. And they're 50,000 square feet. And then I have a 9-acre parking lot in the back where they rent truck spaces, parking for tractor trailers. So parking is great also in industrial. A lot of people don't think of it. What do you do if you have a lot of surface parking?
Yeah, what I'm getting at is what's really popular are really small bays where they're roughly 2,000, 2,500 square foot for the contractor garages, landscapers, drywallers, painters.
That's what we have. And sometimes they're 2,500 square feet and sometimes they're 5,000 feet. We see a lot of these for sale sometimes where they're all 3,000 square feet. And we like those. because people have never moved out. Those are people that you think about might have been at one point in their garage. And their wife says, get the hell out of here. You're in the house, you're making a mess. And they don't want to go back to their basement or their garage. So 2,500, 3,000 square feet is good. And in some locations we've seen, again, the plumber, the sheetrocker, the painter, one guy actually grew coral. Somebody raised tropical fish. We see all these interesting uses in some of these really small ones.
Yeah, we've had churches open inside of a flex space.
Yes, churches are kind of interesting. Because there was never any place in the master plan for almost any city to figure out where do houses of worship go. So a lot of them end up either in single-story office parks or they end up in this flex space. And I like them as sort of a complementary use because they don't need the parking during the week when everybody else does. So they sort of fit in. Nobody knows they're there. It's just a question of getting comfortable with the lack of credit and not being able to get a significant security deposit, if any.
Erwin, let's contrast the larger flex spaces with the 2,000, 1,500 square foot spaces, because a lot of our listeners are likely in that space where they're buying flex spaces that might be 10, 15,000 square feet, but chopped up into roughly 2,000 square foot spaces. They may not have looked at larger buildings with larger spaces. So let's contrast a 2,000 square foot space with 10,000 square foot individual spaces. Let's start with power. What kind of power do you install on the smaller spaces?
Well, the smaller spaces typically have less power. It might be your regular 110, unless there's some appliances that are 220, like your HVAC system. There might be gas in there if you have a ceiling-mounted heating plant with a blower. You also tend to get shorter-term leases on the really small spaces, 2 or 3 years at a time, where once you get 5 or 7,000 square feet and up, it's easier to get 5 or even a 10-year lease on some of the space. Because if the tenant needs a larger space, they're probably going to make a significant investment on their own, which means they're likely not to move. And I think as people that have current investments in some of these smaller spaces, they're great to start to understand the business. These smaller ones are also typically gross leases, where you're not passing through all the operating expenses to the tenants, because the tenants that are typically there don't understand it. So it might be a gross lease where if you trade up to larger buildings, maybe you had a 50 or 75,000 square foot building, slightly larger tenants there, you might, A, you get better credit, B, you might get longer leases, and C, I think you'd be able to share some of the operating expenses, if not all of them, with your tenants.
We'll get back to the show with first some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. If you're an investor like me, you're probably looking for one platform to manage the banking and finance needs of your entire portfolio. The good news is, there is one. It's called Baselane, and it's the number one banking platform built for independent real estate investors that reduces busy work so you can focus on growing your business. With Baselane, you can earn up to a 4.19% annual percentage yield and 5% cash back on debit card spending with no monthly fees. With a simplified view of your cash flow and expenses, you can retire those tedious spreadsheets. You can also manage unlimited virtual accounts and cards, and even open separate accounts for each property or unit. Join more than 40,000 real estate investors who trust Baselane for their banking, property management, and bookkeeping. Head over to baselane.com/Joe and sign up today for a chance to win a $500 Amazon gift card. That's baselane.com/Joe.
With the larger tenants, do you have to do a deeper credit check on them?
We always do a credit check on them, but the larger tenants definitely can get several months security deposit. A lot of times we look at where they're located now, and I might call the landlord just to see how it is a tenant. Sometimes it's they've outgrown the space or they're moving the space because the CEO or the head of the company lives closer by. Or something like that. It's closer to their supply routes, can move closer to their key customers, some of the really larger spaces. But on the larger spaces, you can typically get better credit tenants.
Do you typically get personal guarantees, corporate guarantees, or both?
Sometimes if it's a sole proprietor, somebody has their own LLC, we'll ask for a personal guarantee on the rent. In some cases, we do get a corporate guarantee if there's a parent company. You get what you can get. Sometimes you get 6 months security deposit and you know you can evict them in 90 days based on the local municipality.
Erwin, which type of asset gives you better returns, the smaller properties or the larger ones?
The smaller ones tend to trade at much higher cap rates. 70,000 square feet I'm looking at now in Atlanta, the asset manager is based in Australia. It's their last asset. And they called me up and said, we've spoken to you a few times in the last year. Make us an offer. And I made an offer on a 10 cap and I was surprised they accepted it. And my investors are saying, we don't understand. Why are they selling? I'm like, don't ask. It's a gift. Sometimes you have it. Sometimes it works out that way. But I'm seeing a lot of really small deals. If you're starting out and you want to buy something with two or three tenants, there's a lot of smaller stuff, you know, between 8 and 10% unleveraged return that's probably under $5 million. If you want to play around with it, that's where I would start. You might have two tenants. It might be a 100,000 square foot building even with three tenants and bigger tenants. But there's a lot of low price stuff out there, as I think a lot of mom and pops don't know where the future is. And they've owned it forever. They have no basis in the building. And they just want to take their money and go somewhere else.
Erwin, you've been in this industry for quite some time and you've seen some market cycles. What are your thoughts about the current state of the economy and real estate investing?
I think everybody is trashing the Federal Reserve. I think the economy ran really hot for a long time, especially coming out of COVID. There was a tremendous amount of cash that was pumped in, and they probably should have either let the balance sheet run off earlier or started the rate increases at an earlier point in time. And if you look at the price increase and the cap rate compression that started in 2010, it went up for such a long time. It was a really long, expansive real estate cycle. And how low can cap rates get? How low can interest rates stay? And I think we're overdue for a correction. I think that when a tenant is paying 40 or 50% of their income towards rent is a problem. So I think that maybe that's why in certain areas you're seeing tremendous turnover with the tenants. And as I said earlier, how many times can you renovate an apartment in 12 years? You look at how many times these things have turned over. So I think the market will get a shakeout. And when I look at who has loans in trouble, whatever city it is, and you look at these guys who are running these platforms, I think a lot of them were in high school or college back in 2007, 2008, 2009, and they've really never seen the waves that the cycle can have over a 20-year period. They were finance guys. They financially engineered stuff, and that's why I think some of it's in trouble. If you didn't have to take a full-term interest rate cap, you didn't. But I've also seen on our one remaining apartment building in Virginia Beach when we bought it, I could renovate a one-bedroom apartment with a granite countertop, new cabinets, and a plank floor for about $10,000 or $12,000. Now it's over $20,000. So as all this stuff has escalated, the supply chain has caused a lot of this, a shortage of labor. So people just became a little more creative, which I think is going to cause some of the distress. I've looked at some of the models that some of my investors have from some of their multifamily deals where expenses grew at 1.5% while revenue grew at 10% a year. And I also think that some investors in the last 3 years got lazy, because if you've been investing in multifamily since 2010, all the leaky boats came off the bottom of the ocean. Everybody was making money hand over fist. And they figured, oh, I made money in the last three syndications. I'm going to do another one. And they did no due diligence on their own. So part of it I have to blame on the investors themselves. But I've seen a lot of creative modeling that's done. And actually, some investors have told me that the sponsors wouldn't even share a working model with them, which should have been a red flag. Because you have to be able to stress the deals on your own to see there. So I like real estate as a hard asset. I think there's going to be a market correction. When you look at $50 billion of maturities the next 2 years, the Federal Reserve is not going to drop rates fast enough to rescue all of these deals. Some of them will eventually work themselves out. Some of them will get taken back by the banks. People, unfortunately, are going to lose some money.
You mentioned the Federal Reserve. The headlines, the last time Powell spoke was, Fed indicates 4 rate cuts in 2024. And when you watch Powell's speech, he said nothing of the sorts. But the world ran with that. Oh, good, the Fed's cutting 4 times. And it was one Fed president that ended up making that comment. And it was taken way out of context. This morning, I saw a headline in the Wall Street Journal, and we're in March of 2024, that said Powell indicates rate cuts are coming. And I didn't dive into the article yet. But real estate people and Wall Street people want to believe that we're getting massive rate cuts coming. What are your thoughts? And do you think rates could possibly go up higher?
That was one commentary I heard last week when they're looking at the data. The data is moving in the right direction. And I just think they want to see it move some progression and it continue to move in the right direction where consumer prices are going down, employment is waning off where there's not a lot of job growth. They're looking for enough of the right indicators in succession before they do some rate cuts. I don't think you see anything before July, if you see one. And if anything, I think it's two rate cuts this year, personally. It's been election year, so we have one candidate who spins everything. Everyone's working against him, especially when he appointed Jerome Powell to begin with. And there's a separation of powers there. And it's hard, like the lunar module landing on the moon right side up with a new one that they sent up landed sideways in the news. It's really hard to do that job. So he's trying to get it right. And then when you look at where the prices have increased, we're producing more oil now than we have domestically in many years. We just don't have any refining capacity. No one wants to build a refinery. So that's why gas prices are up. When you look at corporate profits, they're just looking at executive pay and corporate profits and shareholder values. That's why the prices have gone up. There's no reason. The supply chain is fixed. The trucking is there. But no one wants to drop their prices on the retail side. So I think some consumers have more of an issue than others. They're becoming a little smarter. But I think you will see some rate cuts this year, but I don't really see many in 2024. If the data continues to go in the right direction, you probably see four in 2025 as well.
No chance of a rate increase, in your opinion?
I think there's always a chance, but I think if they did that, there'd be a big market slide. The market would really sell off, and it would really send the wrong message. He's better off saying it's wait and see. Everything's moving the right direction. We're confident we'll get to rate cuts because now he knows at the right point, do you go to recession or do you get to a soft landing?
Yeah, so control the market sentiment as well. Erwin, what is your best real estate investing advice ever?
Focus on the cash flow. You can't eat IRR. Don't use projected IRR or projected equity multiple as a tool to make a decision on investing with a sponsor. When we talk to our investors, the first thing it says in my email is based on the contractual rents in place, and we believe the interest rate of X percent, we believe distributable income to investors will be 8%, 9%. Because if my business plan is successful, and as the rents are contractually have increases at 3 or 4% a year, if that cash flow continues to grow, there'll be an upper teen IRR. It's just the way the math works. I was taught to underwrite real estate on a 3x5 card. If you were happy with the cash return in the first year, which is pretty much a known, then as you built out your spreadsheet, that's where all the gravy, the significant upside was going to come from. And we look at every asset as if we're going to own it for a very long time. So if the worst thing that happens is I got 10% a year for 10 years and I got my money back and I got the depreciation, it's not so terrible either. That's not what we're out to do, but that's how we look at it. What's the downside risk? Well, I think on some of these value adds where you're buying on a 4 and financing at a 6.5 and you have to bring all this extra capital and buying interest rate caps, it's got to be a perfectly orchestrated ballet. And there's too many factors that I can't control. I don't know how anyone can control what insurance is going to be, my cost of labor, real estate taxes, supply chain for renovations. There's a lot more risk. So you have to really have a lot of risk to go into some kind of investment like that.
Erwin, let's wrap this up with the best ever lightning round. What is the best ever book you've recently read?
I read Born to Laugh, Bullet Flip the Switch, you know, Half Changing Conversation, Robert Cialdini's Psychology of Influence. I like David Goggins' book, The Navy SEAL. So it's about thinking differently, thinking outside the box. And you never stop learning. Even my kids who are in high school and college said, what do you keep going to seminars for? Does I have to do this when I get older? I'm like, yeah, because you're never the smartest person in the room. And anybody who tells you they're the smartest person in the room, you should run from. So I'm always at to see somebody else's angle, which is why, like today, I'm at a conference talking to other people in the industry. Just trading notes. What are you seeing in California? What are you seeing in Oregon, Washington State, and Texas? Because I'm in the Northeast. And everybody sort of got a similar story of here's where the distress is. And they tell me what's going on in California with the multifamily distress and the rent laws and what's going on with industrial. And it's an education process.
Erwin, what's the best ever way you like to give back?
I'm open to helping people. They want to send me an investment. They want to talk to me. I actually went during COVID. I have an educator's license to teach in high school in New Jersey. I substitute them when they call me. I teach financial literacy. And I find that that doesn't start young enough. with the kids. You can't start it when you're 14 or 15. That really should start younger. I was appalled that how many people have a checking account, how many people have a debit card, and no one's raising their hand in the classroom. So I believe in giving back. I sat on the advisory committee for Fordham University's Real Estate Institute. We figured out what curriculum we think would be helpful to help people learn what's going on in the world today. I mentored students. I still mentor people that call me with questions. And even at the conference, people that tell me what's going on, and I try to help a solution. I'm not out to make money. I'm out to give back, because I would think in doing this for so many years, I've learned something. And if I can help somebody, it'll come back to me somehow. It's called karma.
Erwin, how can the best ever listeners reach out to you?
Sure. HeritageCapitalGroup.net, or it's Erwin@HeritageCapitalGroup.net, or you simply can put Erwin Boris in the search bar, Google, and you'll find me. I'm highly searchable.
Well, Erwin, thank you so much for your time today. You've got an amazing outlook on the history of real estate, the outlook on the economy and real estate. Thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed this. I would do it again at a later date. Thank you.
Best ever listeners, thank you for joining us as well. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review. Share this podcast with someone that can benefit from it. Also, follow, subscribe, and have a best ever day.
Hi, best ever listeners. Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and best ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the best ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access. And you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.